The following presentation is brought to you by God Discussion. For a schedule of upcoming shows, please visit www.goddiscussion.net. Belief in a cruel God makes a cruel man. Thomas Paine. The way to see by faith is to shut the eye of reason. Benjamin Franklin. The question before the human race is whether the God of nature shall govern the world by his own laws, or whether priests and kings shall rule it by fictitious miracles. John Adams. It is perfectly evident to my mind that there exists a necessary, eternal, supreme, and intelligent being. This is no matter of faith, but of reason. Voltaire. God gave us reason, not religion. This belief is known as deism. The World Union of Deists, which brings you this podcast, is an international organization dedicated to promoting the message of deism.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of God Gave Us Reason, Not Religion, an official podcast of the World Union of Deists. I'm your host, Jason X, and with me tonight is my co-host, Tim Wingate. Today, we're going to continue to discuss the topic of deism and morality. I predict that this discussion will last for many episodes. That's okay, though, because deism and morality are fundamental ideas that we humans need to understand in order to make the world as sane, good, and happy as possible. Here's my plan. I plan on asking a bunch of questions and giving my answers to them. And I sincerely hope that Tim and a bunch of callers will interject their thoughts frequently so that we will have lots and lots of ideas about deism and morality to hear from. The more interjections, the better. To call in, dial 914-338-0452 or 888-238-8529. Please only use the 888 number for quick phone calls because it costs God Discussion more money than the 914 number. Deism is the philosophy that teaches only the following two things. One, one should base all of one's beliefs on reason. And two, reason leads one to conclude that God, the being who purposefully created the universe, exists or at least probably exists. That's it. Therefore, deists can believe anything that is reasonable. Some deists will agree with everything that I say about morality, and other deists will disagree. That's okay, though, because God didn't tell me or any other human a bunch of commandments. We have to figure out what is good and what is evil by ourselves, using our reason and learning from and teaching each other. Does that sound good, Tim? Well, I think Tim would say yes if he heard me. I'll try to get him on in a little bit. Well, anyways, I'm going to pause for a little bit, and let's see if I can get Tim on. I don't know what's going on here. Tim, can you hear me?
Oh, now I'm unmuted. Thank you.
Oh, you're unmuted. I bet your wife wishes he had a mute button.
No, that's the other way around.
Oh, I hope she's not listening to this podcast.
Hey, after 35 years, we're pretty used to not listening to each other when we need to.
That's probably the reason for your long, successful marriage.
Maybe. Well, you know, I stole this line from Parenting, I think it was. It was the Ron Howard movie. And the old grandma was asked, how was it that, you know, what was it that she had or contributed to the long marriage that she had? And she told, I think it was the granddaughter who was asking her, and she says, well, we just never were mad at each other at the same time.
That's a very sweet answer.
You know, something to that effect.
And it kind of leads to my first question. How should we live? Tim, if your granddaughter asked you how should we live, what would you say?
Well, I think I'd like to for us to define, actually, before we get into how, maybe the best way for me to answer that, how should we live, is that there probably should be some form of standard, some guideline as to how we live, and that would be commonly called morality. But I think we need to understand what the concept of morality actually is.
That sounds good. What's your idea?
Well, as a deist and as a recovering theocratic monarchist, or a theist for short, I believe that nature's creator, through natural law, has exampled for us what is moral, assuming that moral means right and good, correct, all these positive attributes. I also believe that morality is a social concept. It's fabricated by human thought. We reason what morality is or should be through our philosophical and psychological ability to observe and interpret what we see in nature.
Okay.
What is considered immoral in one human era may be considered moral in another. It changes with social ideologies. So conversely, nature is simply based on the cycle of life. No element of nature really acts with any malice of intent. Malice is a philosophical concept that we attribute to determination, I'm doing this purposely to hurt you. And very little is nature doing that. I'm not really explaining malice correctly. Malice is more than just I'm doing this to hurt you. There's more of a deterministic back to it. And what happens in nature is that there's very little malice. It's just simply is as it is. It's just simply nature.
So like the volcano if your village gets destroyed by lava, that's not malicious. That's just the way nature operates.
Exactly. There's no thought, desire, as far as we know, at least not on our level of consciousness and understanding, that the volcano did that because it's mad at us.
Okay. I should point out that in general, deists don't believe that God does it to punish people either. These things just happen because God set up the universe in a certain way.
Right, right. And if we look at what Tom Paine's example of the watchmaker God, mm-hmm. that yes, certain principles, certain laws, physical laws have been set in motion and as they're there. And it's just going to run the way it naturally is supposed to run. It's part of, nature exists. We all exist in the form of some form of energy, some form of frequency, vibration, energy. And we're all governed by natural laws, which include, people have tried to figure them out for thousands of years. I mean, Buddha taught about the five basic natural laws, what they were consistent of. Others have looked at these natural laws.
Excuse me, you mean natural laws pertaining to morality?
Natural laws of what nature
wasn't much of a physicist.
Is. No, I'm talking about natural laws, which also include not only the physical, but some of what we would consider the immaterial or consciousness. I'm not a Buddhist. I'm not against it. I see it as a secular philosophy, which some people have turned into some kind of a religion, even though there's no deity involved per se. You couldn't consider Buddhism to be theistic per se, but all I'm trying to point out is that there's been people for thousands of years who have written about what natural law is and how we derive morality from natural law. Thomas Aquinas, he wrote, he has his five natural laws, and some people have seven, some people have more, less, but two of the laws I think we could probably agree on at least is that we have the natural law of what would be considered impermanence. Things change. Mm-hmm. They don't stay the same. Things change. And the natural law of cause and effect, which some people think is, you know, called karma or kama, dharma, or they get that dharma and karma and all that stuff mixed up, but it's cause and effect. We know that you do something, something else results. It's reality. It's
right,
what
but,
it
but
is.
I think most believers in karma, like that is most Hindus and most Buddhists, would say that if you do good, you get good. If you do evil, you get evil. And, of course, a lot of times that does happen. But let's suppose that I murder my elderly grandmother who's rich, and I get her fortune, and I live a fabulous life. In that case, karma didn't work, at least in this lifetime.
Well, yeah, and this is
that,
this
that,
is
that, part, the Hindus and Buddhists
right. Well, that's the basic concept, and then this is why, of course, we have these different beliefs extend it into the afterlife. And you get into the idea of reincarnation and that you go through cycles. And all that may be true. I don't know. I've never met anybody who went away and came back. That there is not some other scientific explanation for what they thought they experienced. You know, near-death experiences, the NDEs, are all over. You can read about them everywhere. And they are compelling. But it doesn't mean that that's actually what happened. There are scientists who say, hey, that's just the way the brain shuts down when you're about ready to go somewhere. But yeah, I honestly don't know.
Too.
Well, there
think,
is,
think,
but then
I
you got
was,
the...
I think there was this experiment done where, like, something weird was put on the top of a dresser in an operating table, like a Barbie doll or something like that. And nobody who hovered above their body, supposedly, during one of these near-death experiences, saw the thing that was on top of the shelf. It was weird. It was kind of a...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
An interesting experiment.
We do have those stories. So anyway, when we talk about natural law and... Or like I like to repronounce it as natural law, and keep the A as a long A rather than going to the short A, because then we somehow separate natural from nature, and it's not. It shouldn't be. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that in nature, there is no right or wrong. There is no moral or immoral. There's no good or bad. Because nature exists in the form of energy. Everything is conditioned and is subject to change. The energy when you're a baby exists as you grow up to be an adult. I mean, we are made of the common chemicals and substances that everything else is made of. And so it's everything is basically we cannot forever exist in the form of a baby. You know, the law of impermanence. We're going to grow unless we die. And even then, we're going to change into something else. Our bodies will break down. The compounds will go wherever they go or however they go. Everything does continue to change. So
many
leading
scientists believe that the universe itself will continue to expand until the very fabric of the atoms dissipates.
That could very well be true. Fortunately, it'll be. Yeah, well, fortunately, it'll be long after I've changed. You know, my impermanence has taken effect.
Yeah, I don't think it's one way of putting it. Much.
Right. But it's that we're not born good or bad, moral or immoral, but due to our repeated actions and thoughts, which lead to actions or thoughts, which in turn become a habit, which in turn become our character, the kind of person that we are, and that leads us on to a life of doing good or bad or moral or immoral, depending on the relative or our lives relative to the society around us that we're in. And that's just, you know, it's morality is a human perception. And what is considered morally sound to some one person may be considered immoral to another. You know, we know specifically, you know, you and I were talking a little bit before that we started, you know, about this Syria situation, and I was thinking about how that, you know, a lot of Muslims, not all of them, the more fundamentalist ones do, it's incredibly immoral for a female to show any part of her body in public, period. Now, there's all kinds of variations of that. There's Muslims who, you know, they don't care anymore. They're more secular Muslims. You know, they don't care. They understand that. You know, some of them are they could show, you know, some elbow, and they could show some, you know, some ankle, and they could show stuff, and all they got to do is keep their hair covered. That's it. They don't even have to cover their whole face. The reason I bring this up is I was at the mall today with my wife, and, you know, we have a fair amount of Muslims in town, and I saw a whole, you know, the range of Islamic garb for the women. So you know that thing, and even within Christianity, you have that extreme range. I was brought not terribly holiness, but we knew people who were holiness, and they took things, and they, you know, the women just wore all those, you know, Little House on the Prairie type clothes, and they never cut their hair, and you know they never showed an elbow, they never barely showed a wrist or a hand, you know, that kind of thing. So the point is that some people believe that it's extremely immoral, and in some of those Middle Eastern countries, it's punishable by means of extreme physical harm. And so different morality going on around the world. There is no absolute fixed concept. There's no universal good or bad. It's qualitative. It's where biology is quantitative.
Would you say it's subjective?
It is subjective. Absolutely.
Okay, well here's where maybe we disagree, and that's okay. I don't want to, you know, get ahead of myself, but when I answer my own question, how should we live, I always say we should do as much good as we can, and we should always do as little evil as we can, and, you know, I can go on and explain what I think good is and what I think evil is, and I'm willing to say that I don't have a perfect understanding of what good and evil are, but I believe that there actually is real good and real evil, and that if I were smart enough and had enough data, I could tell you exactly what actions are good and what actions are evil.
Well, I think based on what I know of utilitarianism and the writings of Paley and Hobbes,
Mill,
and Bentham, and these folks, you can pretty well, with your utilitarianism thought, you can work out some specifics based on their initial premises about good or bad, or basically the concept of mankind is motivated by either pain or pleasure. And this is something that, you know, Tony Robbins has grabbed from the neuro-linguistic programming people, the NLP folks, that, you know, you either run toward pain and away from pleasure, or you run toward pleasure and away from pain. And so we end in a form of dualism, and I'm not sure that dualism is completely the best way of going. It's not either or. It is very subjective, and it's relative, because that is the reality of nature, rather than just us moralistically, you know, or philosophically coming up with these ideas. But, you know, this is where we get into this idea of morality. Regardless of what you or I or anybody else believes, it is all relative to the individual, and it is relative to society in general.
But is there an objective morality?
How would we determine that? Because if we look, the question is, looking at nature, what does nature show us? If anything, it's the will of the creature or the individual to live.
Hume points out the fact that in the natural state for human beings, life is nasty, brutish, and short. When we're living like cavemen, you know, our life expectancies were short. We often killed each other just to survive or mate, and we often got killed by animals and other human beings. Isn't there like the Steven Pinker, that guy from Harvard, who said that over the eons, the percentage of human beings dying violently has gone lower and lower, and we just happen to think that there's lots of homicides and society is getting worse, but actually fewer and fewer people are being killed as a result of weapons.
Well, I don't know how we can say that considering all the people killed in wars.
Sure, but let's suppose we even go back to the age of the Vikings. Who had a higher percentage of people being killed? People who lived at the age of Vikings or people who live in the 21st century of the United States? Or the 21st century Earth? The Viking Earth or modern Earth?
I don't know, because I have not done any research specifically on that. But considering the 21st century, or I would say the 20th century at the very least, all the wars and the killings of people by government alone, religious organizations as well, who's to say? I don't know how we could determine that.
Well,
I'm not sure I agree with Hume.
I've seen an interview with Pinker, and he's done research on this. He seems like a pretty smart guy, and he just said, and he says the percentage, not the number, the percentage has gone lower. So probably more got killed in the 20th century because there's more people on Earth, and we've had two huge world wars, but it's a lower percentage.
We've had lots of wars, man. See, that's the thing. People are they're not really quite aware of how much killing government actually has done, not only in the 19th but the 20th century as well. When you really look for those stats, you'd be surprised at how many people.
Cambodian genocide.
We could list a lot of different genocides. Yeah.
The Soviet government killed millions.
Yeah, and so I don't know that I'm not real sure that Pinker's research included war. It's been a long time since I've paid any attention to that, so
anyways,
I have to admit
my point is that in a primitive state, life is nasty, brutish, and short, and therefore we decide that we're going to try to make a better society. We human beings decide to do that, and to help make a better society, we try to figure out what makes people the happiest. And that's
you're talking about Stuart Mill, and that I'm not sure I can completely agree with the original premise that you're espousing of Mills. I mean Hume's.
Yeah,
life was short and brutish and violent and everything. That's an assumption that he's making based on some old concepts of cavemen. And our research now today and understanding how these ancients lived, a lot of that caveman stuff and a lot of that concept of how backwards the ancients were, turns out that's completely wrong. That's the theists making up how bad it used to be and our way is better.
I disagree with you. If you're talking about before civilization, before cities –
Well, wait a minute.
People had lower life expectancies than they much lower than they do now, And a lot of them show signs of dying violently. Like, for example, remember that guy who got he was exactly a caveman?
The Iceman found in the Alps?
The Iceman, yeah. He died with an arrow in his back.
Well, yeah, somebody tried to shoot him for whatever reason. But I don't think any of those examples really go to support that premise. You know, talking about how it used to be, our newer, more modern research is showing that the ancients had a high level of civilization. And people lived long lives.
Who are the ancients?
Well, we can go back to Sumerians. We can go to the Egyptians. We can go to the cradle of civilization.
I'm talking about pre-cities, pre-civilization. I'm talking about caveman times.
How would you know that? How would Hume know that?
Well, okay.
What is archaeology? Let's be honest.
I watch the Science Channel all the time, and they show people who, like these bones, and say, well, this person died from trauma. This person was homeless.
Well, they may have, but that's not all the bones. Archaeologists make up stories. My archaeologists make up stories on a tooth. They'll make up a story. Now, they have reasonable ways, or they have a set of logic that they follow, but that's one example. They can't, you know, if they had multiple examples from around the world at the same time, dated the same way, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you could go look at, you know, if there were, I hate to use the example, but Hiroshima or Nagasaki. You could go there and look at that. And if an archaeologist sometime in the future, were they forgotten that we existed or what happened, and they're looking at that, they could draw the same conclusion that, oh, the whole world was radiated and this terrible trauma occurred. See, that's the problem with science, is that people get caught up into their own little theory and their own little idea, and we don't know that it's really that it really applies to everybody. But I think I don't really want to, you know, choke on a camel and, you know, or choke on a gnat, swallow a camel here, so to speak. It comes down to is that I'm not sure ancient life was bad, but the basic premise of utilitarianism, as expressed by Bentham and Mill and Hobbes and, you know, Paley and these other people, is that it's basically what, wouldn't you say it's what is good for a person is generally good?
I would say this.
Utilitarianism is
the ethical theory that every voluntary human action should attempt to achieve the greatest amount of happiness for the greatest amount of creatures, especially humans. And I say, simply speaking, because there are different types of utilitarianism. So whatever.
Well, that's true. And at least I like the.
Is what is good.
Well, yeah, I understand what you're saying, and I appreciate that you use the term voluntary, which is an important aspect to this. That every voluntary.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that are involuntary. Like, let me pick on babies for a moment. Babies are cute and wonderful, and I love them all. But when you have a little baby that's crying, that baby might inadvertently do some kind of harm, like, you know, keep you awake, or what there was an episode of MASH, a horrible episode, you may have recalled it, where everyone on the bus would have died if this mother didn't smother her baby, because the enemy were around, and if they found out that there were people on this bus.
Yeah, I watched that MASH episode. Yeah.
Right. So here's a baby that it was doing something involuntary that would have hurt other people. So,
and the mother did not voluntarily smother the baby. In that episode, the mother did not voluntarily smother the baby. She was just trying to keep it quiet by pressing it against her boob, and didn't realize she accidentally smothered the baby.
Oh, well, I don't know. I'd have to analyze it. Well, but in any case,
look
any,
up on
the
YouTube
point,
the old
point
MASH
is
episode.
That there are voluntary actions and there are involuntary actions. And, of course, we can't control our involuntary actions, and it would do more harm to try. Hey, we're going to take a commercial break here because that's just a good thing to do. Please hold on when we'll have more.
And we'll get into this. We'll get into it. We'll let you do your questions.
God gave us reason and not religion.
Questions, not answers.
God's a big subject. By sharing our stories, we can understand why we believe or not believe, and maybe even find some common ground. From free thought to Christianity, deism to world religions, we have something for you. Our guests include authors, philosophers, scientists, preachers, activists, and folks who have been affected by religious belief in a good or bad way. Log on to goddiscussion.net for our show schedules. There's an at-a-glance calendar there and info on our various hosts and programs. Again, that's goddiscussion.net.
You were born sinless. Your true freedom from sin is here. Declare your freedom from the myth of sin with your own personalized declaration of sinlessness and certification of sinlessness from the World Union of Deists now. Free your mind, body, and emotions with the irrefutable 11 reasons of the declaration of sinlessness. Enjoy life again. Live sin-free. No more groveling at the golden altars of revealed religionists who designed an imaginary disease just so they could sell you an imaginary cure. Both your personalized Declaration of Sinlessness and Certification of Sinlessness are printed in full color on high-quality parchment paper, shipped in their own black and gold frames, ready for immediate display. Help the World Union of Deists. Spread the light of reason and place your order now. Only $25 plus shipping from the World Union of Deists. www.deism.com. You'll be glad you did.
God's a big subject, and with us, anything goes. Irreverent or humble, have your say. We're the Future's Religious Talk Show in Blog Talk Religion.
Join all Deborah, Rob, Timothy, Jason, Colleen, and more hosts.
Shows every week.
Visit GodDiscussion.net for info or call 914-338-0452. Talk, learn, share, think. The God Discussion Network.
Hello, once again, this is Jason X here, along with my co-host Tim Wingate. I am the Deputy Director of the World Union of Deists. We would love to have you call in at 914-338-0452 or 888-238-8529. Please only use the 888 number for a quick phone call because it costs God Discussion more money than the 914 number. The World Union of Deists is an educational organization dedicated to teaching the world about deism so that humanity will be as sane, good, and happy as possible. Our website is www.deism.com. That's www.deism.com. Tim, are you still there?
Yeah, Jason. And I was just thinking, you know, I do want to answer your initial question, and I just wanted to I want to make sure that I wasn't misunderstood or that I didn't misspeak, and that is I am a big fan of the scientific method. And all I'm saying is that some of the guys from the 19th century were writing based on some scientific methods that were not all that accurate and correct as we have become better at it, shall we speak. Good example would be look at the in science of medicine, how Joseph Lister, Louis Pasteur, I'm trying to think of some of the other guys that came up with novel new ideas based on good scientific research, and they were just totally poo-pooed. and written against. And so I'm not saying that Hume is wrong or anything, but I think we have to be cognizant of some logical errors in some of these older philosophical thoughts that claim to be based on observation or scientific method of nature from back then. We know a little bit more now than we did then, but we certainly don't know as much as we think we know. That's
well,
all
I think that you're an intelligent person. You know a lot, and I think that you have a slight inclination different than me, and I think that's one of the things that's good about you and I hosting this program together, because you're more libertarian than I am. I'm a public school teacher by profession. I'm trying to get kids to, you know, to like the government.
Well, I don't know. I wish we had Henry.
There's true and good in both approaches, and hopefully together we can present more true and good to ourselves and to the rest of the world.
Well, I agree with you, Jason. That's why I wish we had Henry back on, because I, you know, reading Henry's book and everything, you know, he he definitely leans toward an anarchical state rather than the authoritarian one that we have
he
today.
He makes you look like a fascist.
Oh, my gosh, no. I don't know. We're both big fans of Lysander Spooner and Albert J. Nock and some of the other some of the early 19th century writers on libertarian philosophy or anarchism. So I, you know, I don't know. I think reason leads us toward some of these things. But to answer your question, how should we live? I think that I would have to agree that we should do as much good as we can, at least what we perceive to be good, as long as what we perceive to be good is not in complete, total conflict with our society and our family and our friends and whatever. I'm not saying we should not be who we are, but I don't know. I used to use this example with my mother, you know, who she used to, you know, quote the Bible to me about.
Keep on talking to
people.
I would call her, okay? Keep on talking.
Oh, okay. Well, my mom used to quote the thing to me because I would argue with her about the concept of religion and getting saved and needing to be saved. She quotes St. Paul over about, you know, even those who haven't heard about Christ would, you know, in their natural state, they know, they see nature and they recognize God. And I used to make the argument that, well, what if I was a cannibal in some place, some other country, and I was a cannibal and I thought it was perfectly good to, you know, catch an enemy and cook them up and eat them. You know, am I going to go to hell for that? Especially if I never heard about, you know, her version of what she thought Christianity was. And, you know, it's hard. It's hard to answer that question from a biblical standpoint once you understand all the nuances of the New Testament. It's just the argument cannot necessarily be sustained. Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, no. We have Phil from the UK again here, and he had something that he wanted to share, and I thought it would be good for the audience to hear. Go ahead, Phil.
Go for it, Phil. Welcome.
Okay, yeah, basically I've been listening into the show. I'm trying to get a handle of how deists get their ideas of good and evil. Not getting a lot just at the moment. Jason seems to be saying that it's all to do with creating the most happiness. And Tim seems to suggest that it comes from nature, but I don't fully understand that because there doesn't appear to be good and evil in nature. It's
That's what I said. That's right, Phil.
So where do you
right,
get
and,
your...
And what I was trying to say, Phil, was that this is my opinion. I think Tim might disagree with it. I think when there's a when people don't have when people decide to form societies, they have to learn how to get along with each other, and that's when I think that utilitarianism is valuable, because we can work together using utilitarianism to try the most happiness from those people. So I'd say whatever brings the most happiness from those people is good, and whatever doesn't is evil. Tim is saying that that nature is neither good nor evil, but maybe he has something to say about how we figure out what good and evil are.
Well, that's the point. I agree with Phil. And Phil, by the way, thanks for staying up late. I know it's like going on 3 o'clock there.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I appreciate you staying up in the early morning and listening in to the show. And you were right. I don't think that nature shows us good and evil. But I'm not saying I'm absolutely right on that, because there's so much philosophy that's available to us, that there are those who have taught and have believed that there is intrinsic good and intrinsic evil even within nature. And that would be evident by negative mutation that occurs. That's one example. Or that some people just seem to be what we would consider evil or destructive, such as a sociopath or a psychopath.
Sorry to interrupt you, Tim.
No, go ahead.
When you're talking about nature, I'm thinking of non-human. Yeah, there is nothing. Where do you actually get your definition of what is good and what is evil from? Where does it come from?
Okay, that's a very good question. Where do I get my I have to go to some degree on what is good for me and mine. What is good, what is contributes the to our best well-being for me and mine. Not for society in general, it's for me and mine.
So,
this is where I disagree with the concept of utilitarianism.
Again, Tim, I'm very sorry to interrupt you on this, but what's best for you? So, if you were hungry, would you steal somebody else's food?
Hell yeah.
Yeah?
Why should I starve?
Well,
why should I starve just because somebody's made up rule about, oh, I can't take some food from them? Now, my own definition or my own way of doing it is I wouldn't take all their food. I just want enough so that I don't starve or that my family doesn't starve.
Well, what,
you know?
what if it's either or? What if you take they've only got a small amount of food, it's just enough for them, and you take that from them, so they starve or you starve? Would you take the food or would you not?
You know, it honestly depends on who and what that person is. This is where relativistic values and how I was feeling at the time. It's a hypothetical I've never encountered, and I don't know how I would handle it. I'd have to be in that situation. I'm not sure, though, I would obligate myself to any set of rules, but I don't know. You know, I would like to think that I would talk with them and work out something that the two of us, let's say together, could figure out how to get more food for the both of us.
Well, I think you're just skirting around a little bit now.
No,
and
I'm
and
not.
Surely,
this is like the lifeboat. No, this is like the old lifeboat scenario of, you know, who, you know, you got certain people in the lifeboat and the boat is being swamped. Somebody needs to be thrown over. And that sets up a false situation that does not necessarily have to be. You can have people floating in the water and people trading in and out of the boat. You don't have to have these hard, fast scenarios as a hypothetical. I'm not necessarily going to do that. I'm not really skirting the issue, but I'd like to think
using your own example, everyone on the Titanic would have been saved.
Well, I don't know about the
sometimes
Titanic.
You,
I mean, there's a whole lot of details on that, pal. There's a whole lot of.
Sometimes you have to make a decision. It's either that person survives or that person survives. You said something a little bit further back there. You said something like, well, I can't set a set of rules on this. Well, surely society needs a set of rules to exist with. And it's this set of rules which has been derived from the revealed religions that most of us take our definition of good and evil.
Yeah, but then
from.
Okay, look at the success of the story of Les Miserables and Jean Valjean. And how
I've
and
not
how
seen,
he,
I've
well,
not seen
I mean
it,
it's an old story.
Comment.
It's an it, read the book. It's better than the movie, but I mean
well,
the movie
okay,
is wonderful
either,
with the music. But
either way, I've not read the book or seen the movie.
Oh, okay. Well, the concept is that he broke one of society's rules to be able to feed a child or his family.
Yeah.
He stole a loaf of bread, and then he's pursued endlessly by, obviously, you know, an anal retentive officer of the rules, who eventually, you know, in well, you know, the old saying is, you know, in the end everybody dies, but ruin the movie for everybody. Victor Hugo was dealing with a whole concept of this concept of morality in the story, and it really is relative. So, I mean, I don't want to skirt the issue, but I can't answer what would I do specifically. It depends on who the person was who had the food, honestly. If it was a child, I would like to think that I'd say, nah, I'm next generation, maybe it's better that you I'm not one to take candy from babies necessarily, unless their teeth are rotten out. Then maybe that's something that needs to be done.
Yeah.
But I can't answer. I honestly can't answer
the problem,
specifically.
The problem is then we end up with no rules.
No, we end up with no rulers.
No,
but
we end up with no rules.
The thing is, most people.
You see,
this is the funny.
What you're saying is you can't. You cannot. Specify a set of rules. You can do this, you can't do that. In this situation, this is allowed. You're saying none of that's possible. So society.
No, I'm saying it is
no
possible.
Rules.
I'm not. I agree. It is possible. People do it. They've been doing it for thousands of years of human history. Society setting up rules, setting up laws, and or codes,
yeah.
And enforcing
mainly based
them.
Mainly based on revealed religions. What I'm trying to get at is how does deism do it?
May I just interject a little bit here?
Go for it.
I want to point out that deism is a theological position, just like atheism is a theological position and agnosticism is a theological position. Atheism, agnosticism, deism all assert that we should base our beliefs on reason, but they say reason leads one to conclude different things. Atheism says that reason leads one to conclude that God does not exist. Agnosticism leads one to conclude that one cannot conclude whether God exists or not. And deism leads one to conclude that God, the being who purposely created the universe, exists, or at least probably exists. And the reason I bring this up is that deism is not a moral position. If God exists but God is evil, then it would make sense to be evil. Most deists, though, I think are good people, but I just want to bring that up. I don't think there's any one clear answer where we can say deism teaches this about morality.
Yeah. One of the impressions I get from all the written word, all the emails that I get from Bob and yourself, I'm sure, is that we would all like to improve the world. We would all like everybody to get on a lot better and embrace deism. So I you'll have to excuse me. In England, we say deism.
It sounds charming.
Yet, thank you.
Charming.
And yet...
I'm going to kick you in your trunk, I'll tell you.
go ahead, Phil.
How are we going to bring all these people to deism when we can't actually say, well, this is what we believe in. This is how we should behave.
Well,
I do have an answer to that question. The vast majority of humanity believes that the universe was purposely created, and I think that the main reason the vast majority of humanity believes that is that the universe looks like it's purposely created. Now, atheists, agnostics, and deists would all agree that humanity would be better off basing their beliefs on reason. Well, if you want humanity to base their beliefs on reason, deism is going to work a lot better than atheism and agnosticism because humanity, at least the majority of humanity naturally believes that God exists. So if we can get a high percentage of theists, that is people who believe that God exists, to become deists, then at least they're basing their beliefs on reason. And those who base their beliefs on reason tend to be more moral than those who don't. And one of the reasons why is that they don't do stupid things about a faith. They don't say, well, the Pope told me to go attack Jerusalem, and heck, he's the vicar of Christ, so I'll do it. No, they say, let's help us improve about this. Or they won't say, you know, the Bible says we should burn witches, and, you know, my priest said that woman there is a witch, so I should burn her alive. Reason would stop that. So that's my answer to that question.
Well, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, wouldn't it be wonderful if the whole world could reason that way? First of all, I don't think the whole world. I agree with you that most of humanity believe that the universe was created by God. Unfortunately, most of them don't believe it from a reason point of view. They believe it from a somebody told me point of view, right?
I actually think it's both. I think it's both. I think, you know, when we look at the stars and the trees and human beings, it really doesn't appear to most people to have been an accident. So I really think that there's a philosophical reason as well as most people are raised to believe that God exists. I
don't know. I have to side with Phil on this. I think that there's because of the prominence, the how much revealed religion there is in the world, if you were to caucus these people to actually do a reasonable scientific-based sampling of people. And I think some of these things have been done. I know Pew Research does this in the U.S. as far as how many people believe in God and where did they get their concepts. These things are there. But most of this seems to – I would agree that it comes from people's exposure to revealed religion primarily, not so much an observation of nature.
I will bring up an argument that backs me up a little bit. There have been cultures all over the world that have been isolated for millennia. You know, the people in South America and Europe and in Australia. And yet all these people have had creation myths. They all think that the gods, and in some cases God, created the universe. I think the reason that this is a universal human phenomenon is that to most people it seems that the universe was purposely created.
Well, I could argue from Joseph Campbell's position of mythology, and that is that there was an actual event that occurred, and it's just been completely mythologized by all these different people. But
the other thing is, so I'm getting the names right, Jason, is that it's almost like I have to excuse you, I'm not quite as well read as you two, but the humanists and all that say that, well, you believe in God because man has a need to believe in God.
Mm-hmm.
So you're almost arguing there, Jason, for the humanists, the human, you know what I mean, the human,
yeah,
human.
Well, humanist point of view.
Yeah.
People, a lot of people want life after death, and they think, well, and I think correctly, they think if God does not exist or the gods do not exist, there will not be life after death. So that is a bit of a motivation, but not every society that believed in God believed in life after death. The original Israelites strongly believed in God, but they didn't believe in life after death. They thought that there was Sheol, the abyss, emptiness. And there's probably some others, but I can't think of another one at this time.
Well, no. Let's get back to maybe what Phil was trying to say. As deists, where do we get our concepts of morality? Following along the line, Phil, that you brought up, is that I would have to admit that I get a lot of my morality out of my revealed religious past.
Well, this is
what is good and what is not. I'm not sure that I've really been able to observe. I mean, what I see in nature is that it's predator or prey. There's a few creatures that seem to be apart from that concept of predator or prey, the food chain, that whole concept, and that animals act as animals are. And occasionally, though, we have stories where an animal seems to be extending compassion to something that would normally be prey, but it doesn't.
Yeah, I think they're perhaps just little anomalies, basically.
You might be right. And as humans, we tend to anthropomorphize everything.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
I would like to say that I try to base all my beliefs on reason, and at least my reason says that I want to live in a world where people are trying to make each other happy. So that's why I favor utilitarianism.
Yeah, I sort of like that. I like where you're coming from there, Jason. But there are some dilemmas with it,
aren't there, Phil? I feel a little hinky about it, as we say. There's some problems with it. Like Jason likes to say that. I know he's got kind of a line of reasoning he wanted to develop here. We're kind of jumping around. Jason, your quote. Your statement about the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few,
or the one,
or the one, which is a quote from Star Trek, Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan. That's what Spock said,
and
so did Jeremy Bentham.
Consider that an axiom.
Yeah, it's Jeremy Bentham said that as well. So. Who became a utilitarianism philosopher, great, very influential in that concept. So, I have a problem though with those with the exceptions to that situation. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. To bring up Phil's hypothetical with me, what if it was my family, not just me? What if it was my wife and my three daughters who are all hungry and the one person has the food? Now It's my many. It's not just me. It's me and mine against the one. And that would be utilitarian.
Right. And let me address that. It's kind of funny. I wrote a book called Expanded Deism where I start off saying that I like utilitarianism. When I was writing this, I thought to myself, utilitarianism is a good rule of thumb, but there seem to be some exceptions to it. And then I started thinking, you know, morality might be like golfing. The goal is to get the ball in the hole, and you use different clubs at different times. I don't know, maybe utilitarianism at one point, maybe the golden rule at another point. But then I thought about it more and more, because I thought about an exceptions like you were saying, and I thought that, well, the reason you don't want your family to starve is that you want to be happy. So maybe there's not so much...
Or I want them to be happy.
Or you want them to be happy. Anyways, maybe there's not such a conflict as initially seems. We would not be happy, I think, living according to rules that would make us not provide for our families.
Well, no, we wouldn't be happy, but so many people have been in that situation and just submitted.
Right, but
once again, in a way,
that kind of doesn't undermine utilitarianism as much. Maybe in a way, it supports it a little bit.
Don't we have those rules anyway, Jason? I mean, it's against the law to steal. So even if you had that situation where one person had food, your whole family was starving, you're still being told you live in a society where you're not allowed to take that food. You're not allowed to look after your family by stealing.
Well,
right,
yeah,
I think the British did.
No offense to you. I was going to say, Philip, no offense to you, but that is what the British did to the Irish.
I'm not attacking.
Yeah. I'm just using that as an example of where food was being shipped out of Ireland during the potato famine, and
hey,
the Irish were not allowed.
I'm going to talk to a caller. I'll be right back.
Oh, okay.
Keep on talking.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be political, Philip. Really, I'm part English myself. You know, last name Wingate. Yeah, that's English. So, my kids ask, you know, what part's the English? I go, he's the butler, the English butler, which is a famous thing here in the States. You know, it's a classic.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
But It comes down to, you know, where do we get our concept of what is right and wrong and morality? And I don't want to jump ahead with Jason's thing, but the idea that what makes the most happiest
brings the greatest happiness for the greatest number.
Yeah, the greatest happiness for the greatest number. But, you know, how do you define that? That, you know, is that 51% gets to make life miserable for the 49?
I think what I don't like about it, I do like it as a concept, as an altruism, if that's the right word. But what I don't like about it is it's practically impractical. You know, you can't have,
I like that.
You have to have a rule, thou shalt not steal. Sorry, I'm using biblical stuff. You're not allowed to steal.
Yeah.
It's against the law, right? But if you start trying to make that law, well, in this case you can. In that case, maybe if we add up those numbers and divide it by these numbers, you cannot base a society on this most happiness for most people concept. I can't see a way of making it work.
Wait, well, let me interject, gentlemen. I'm going to say my bit, and then we're going to hear from Rico, who just called in. But my bit is this. Obviously, for society to function and be as happy as possible, there has to be a rule against stealing. But practically everyone knows that, you know, maybe sometimes stealing might be the right thing to do, such as in that book that was brought up, Les Mis, by Victor Hugo. This guy's family was starving to death. It wouldn't have done much harm for him to steal the bread and save his family, so he did, and that's probably the right thing. Utilitarianism, and I know it's not as popular as I wish it was, supports the idea of the rule thou shalt not steal, but also supports appropriate exceptions such as Jean Valjean stealing bread in a way that won't really hurt anyone to help his family. Now I'd like to hear from Rico. Rico, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi, where are you calling from, Rico?
Welcome, Rico.
Thank you. I'm calling from California.
Very good.
Hey, my little take on just the discussion that I just heard. It's like, I put it like this. If in the civilization where you have righteous people, you know, that are morally upstanding and right, you wouldn't need law, you know, because everyone is into the golden rule, per se. Do unto your brother as you would have them do unto you. But in an unrighteous world, in an unrighteous society, you have to have some kind of laws imposed. Now, that's still encouraging people to do the morally correct thing, which is, like, for instance, in Les Miserables, where Jean Valjean had to steal to provide or defeat his program. That's why you would have, it would be a need for a charity or, in some instances, to help or paying alms, however you want to call it. But in a, you know, you don't give laws to righteous people, you know what I mean? If everyone's doing unto their brothers, they would have them done, you wouldn't need laws, you know, but seeing how we live in a society or civilization where there's wrongdoing, you would need some kind of laws in order to uphold society. It has to have some kind of structure to it. It's just my opinion.
I agree with you, Rico. I think if we took, like, the most moral people in the world and put them on an island, they wouldn't need too many laws, at least. But obviously, you know, every society is a mixture of trustworthy and untrustworthy people, knowledgeable and unknowledgeable people.
True. I agree.
Go ahead, Rico.
Oh, no, I was just saying, yeah, I agree. You know, in an idealistic way, you know, it'd be nice to live in a society where it's like Canada, per se, where you don't have to lock your doors and, you know, everybody just, like, for instance, your child wanders out, or you can say, like, I got to go somewhere, and it's like, hey, I'm going to leave him with the neighbors without knowing that the neighbor is a pedophile or something like that, is going to kill my child. Or it'd be nice to live in a society or a world like that, you know, where everybody can live in peace, you know. So.
Yeah, it would be. Well, I think people like Tim, Phil, myself, and you are trying to make a world closer to that. Of course, I don't expect we'll ever get there, but it's better to be closer than to be farther away.
Yes, I agree. Better sooner.
Yeah,
than
and I think we gotta. I think we gotta also recognize. You know, we call it human nature. It's how people are naturally seem to be. Laws imposed by an authority sometimes work, and many times they don't, and actually create more of a problem than what they were trying to alleviate. Prohibition being one good example, the drug war being another great example. People will want to do what people want to do, and this concept that there are so-called things called vices, and the concept that they're a vice actually comes out of an authoritarian, hierarchical, revealed religious mentality. I think that works against what nature is and the way people are. And it just creates more problems because now it creates a criminal class. You must follow the rules. If you don't, you're a criminal. You've broken the law, and you must be punished. And that's a whole artificial construct. Philosophically, it's an artificial construct.
No, I don't.
Because it doesn't have to be.
Tim, I'm sorry, mate. Well, you mix something up there because we've all agreed that you have to have laws. You have to have rules for society to work.
Well, rules.
Rico,
I'm not sure that I want to go. Well, I think there are. I think there always are rules that people naturally gravitate toward.
So
if you get
what
a group
do you do
of people,
if people break the rules.
Well. That's where we have our disagreements on the structure of politics or the structure of a government. And is the government something that is an authority that imposes what it calls justice, or is that really an imposition of rules to keep certain people down for the benefit of a few at the top?
Well, okay, I agree that the, most governments in the world have brought out rules that aren't necessarily the essential rules. They've brought them out to sort of keep some people down or whatever else. But you've still got the situation where you have the basic rules of society, and if somebody breaks those rules, then they are a criminal. You have to have that. You have to have some sort of punishment for breaking the rules of society.
Well,
let me ask
you. I'm not sure that
Could you agree with this statement? And I say this to a lot of people. I even say it to my students. I say that I'm all for maximizing freedom, and as long as it doesn't hurt someone else. So I say sane adults should be able to do whatever they want as long as they don't obviously hurt someone else. Would you agree with that?
I'd absolutely agree with that perfectly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I would agree with that. And this is really leads into the beginning, Jason, where you talked about volunteerism, people who do things voluntarily. This is where, as a society, you know, as long as we can agree together on what the rules are going to be.
Well, can I interject something in a sense? I think the necessary problem with, you know, all right, for instance, people being allowed to do what they want to do and people being having rules imposed on them, I think the problem needs to be discussed is human nature. Can human nature be changed to some degree? If you can go to the root of what's causing human nature to deviate, per se, from, you know, them doing something, quote-unquote, immoral, you know what I mean, or deciding what is moral, what is immoral, if you can deal with that aspect as a whole, then I think you can eliminate that problem altogether. For instance, if a person has a need to steal, for instance, they're a compulsive, kleptomaniac, if you will.
Yeah, kleptomaniac.
And, yeah, so, you know, I think going into the psychological aspects of why a person does a certain thing is needed. And if you can eliminate that aspect in the human being, then therefore you can make a better society as well.
Well, yeah, I would agree with that, but the problem we always encounter with this is that who makes this happen? How does this happen? And do they do it at the point of a bayonet, or is it people voluntarily agreeing to participate in this? And this is an ongoing argument and discussion for, well, at least in the United States, since the imposition of the Constitution by a few people upon the rest of the country, thought they were living under the Articles of Confederation.
Well, then you have to then go to societies where it has worked. You know, there's history.
There have been societies. There have been anarchical societies, and they've existed for a long time up until, you know, they themselves, what for whatever reasons, disintegrated and or were conquered by more hierarchical authoritarian regimes, such as how Rome took over most of Europe and imposed a hierarchical centralized authoritarianism, and then that was eventually subsumed by the Roman Catholic Church, which continued the same kind of practice that was subjugating the people, the indigenous people of Europe, and their country religion, which then became a pejorative called paganism.
Yeah, and religion often does strengthen the resolve of an authoritarian type of regime, if you will, because it solidifies, it gives them a sense of purpose in the sense that they're doing this with a will greater than themselves. But
I told Jason early on, I used to be a theocratic monarchist. I believed in the theocracy and the kingship of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that Jesus was never here to actually sit on a throne and administer justice or rule or law. It was always representatives who said that they heard him whispering to them. you know, the revelators of the revelation. And so, you know, this is our problem, is when we get into this concept of right and wrong, good and evil.
Well, I think,
Phil had the great question, you know, where do we get our concept of right and wrong?
I think it comes from the law of cause and effect, not to interrupt.
Well, there you go, the law of cause and effect, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, and
go
and
ahead,
that,
Rico, elaborate.
I think the law of cause and effect has a great bearing on society. And that's where cause and effect comes from. Morality comes from that law of cause and effect. It's the energy that you're putting into the atmosphere or your environment. If you're interjecting a lot of negativity, then you're attracting that negativity. And if you're putting out a lot of positive energy, then you're attracting it. And I think people today, the human being today on the planet, doesn't have a sufficient amount of knowledge of the cause and effect, and that's what's causing us to do things. And then we get things happening back to us, and we don't, you know, we're blaming this person, thus bringing on more and more. And I think it's going to continue until we do come to a sufficient amount of knowledge of that law, you know. And that's the church doesn't explain it right. It's not do unto others or God's going to kill you. No, it's do unto others because it's more beneficial for you, you know. It makes things more harmonious, you know. You don't steal you don't steal from your brother because you're going to end up getting stolen from. You know, you help your brother because you're going to want help, and so on and so forth. So I think that's the core of it, is the law of cause and effect and the insufficient amount of knowledge of that law.
Well, I think the value of what you're saying, Rico, is that it helps you be a positive person, and also when we do good, we make society good, and a good society is better to live in than an evil one.
And I agree. And I think that's one of our biggest problems in this world now. It's like we do a lot of things and we don't, you know, it's like I hear it all the time. Why does God kill babies? And it's like people kill babies, you know. And, sometimes, you know, it's the environment that the baby's living in. Maybe it wasn't conducive. There's a reason and explanation for everything. It's just not like, you know, it's just happening. Things don't just happen. There's reasons for it. And until we tune in or raise our vibrations high enough to where we can tune into how things are happening or pay attention to it, then, you know, we can better affect our environment.
They don't hate us because of our liberty. They hate us because we've been bombing their kids.
I agree with that. You know, you can't lie on the people and go in there and bomb the hell out of them and then say, well, you know, they're terrorists. It's like, well... Goes both ways, you know.
Well, I think there's been injustices on both sides. You know, I mean, obviously, the destruction of the Twin Towers was a great evil, but maybe the United States supporting the Shah of Iran was just as evil. I don't know, but there's been evil on both sides, and I definitely want my side to have less evil and more good than it's had, and that way the other side has less of a reason to attack it.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, I think if we involve ourselves in more domestic issues as far as like health care or, you know, repealing the law that they currently have on health care or education or clean and green energy or, you know, different types of projects that will help us here, if we're more focused on our own selves as opposed to what's going on in other countries, then I think we'll be, you know, better off, you know, fix our own economy in a sense. As opposed to just, well, we'll just go take somebody else and increase our economy that way. And it's not even a trickle-down effect. It's you know, the have-have and the have-nots are going to continue to have. It's like a feudalism system. It's not going to work, you know. The idea of capitalism was correct, but, you know, the outcome is disastrous because you have some people that get a lot and don't give back, you know. And if everybody in the country had jobs, we wouldn't have crime, you know.
There's a lot of, you know, you're, Rico, you're very astute, and there are a lot of factors that are involved with that. And, you know, Jason, I would have to say that to me the greater evil is that evil is done in my name, and I have not authorized that evil. Authorization
yeah.
was assumed.
My tax dollars are being used to drop bombs where I don't want them dropped.
Well, the argument, you see, this is the problem most people don't realize with the concept, and I'm not arguing that representativism is wrong, but a representative government such as we've got in our structure of representativism or republicanism is actually that we have given tacit approval to them to basically do whatever they want to do. As long as we get to vote for a representative, then we have a voice, and we're a participant.
Right, but this is also assuming. I first of all, I want to say that, you know, I agree wholeheartedly with the Declaration of Independence when it says that
yeah.
government derives its just powers from the consent of the governed. That's why
that's
I
right.
like the Republican and Democratic model, a Democratic Republic. But the question is the United States as democratic as it should be, that, as its system of gerrymandering acceptable, is its political machinery so transparent that we know that every vote counts and counts once? And I don't think that the United States is as democratic as it should be. I want
well,
to be more
that,
democratic.
Well, there's a problem with the concept of democracy then, too, because democracy quite often, United States was not set up as a democracy. That's a complete misnomer. It was set up as a republic, a representative republic, not using democratic principles of voting or a majority. And this is why we've had that you don't win things on just a simple majority. There needs to be an actual majority, maybe a two-thirds majority in some cases. And that way there's a clear majority and a clear will being expressed. And that's democracy, which this is what utilitarianism kind of reminds me of sometimes, because I think it ends up evolving into democracy. And democracies have been, the Founding Fathers says that they've been not only violent but short. Looking at the
I would say that compared to most of the governments that came before it, the United States was more of a democratic republic compared to ones that came before it. And I'm just telling you where I stand, where I would like to live in a nation that's a complete democratic republic. Now, of course, we have to worry about the tyranny of the majority, which is why education is so important. You know, educate, you know, people about treating each other well and giving them rights. I think the United States has gotten better over time by becoming more democratic, by giving women the right to vote, and by giving African Americans the right to vote. I'd like to see this trend continue.
Tim, Jason, please. Hello.
Yeah, yes, Phil.
Yeah, look, I'm sorry, lads, but you're actually talking American politics now, and it's 3:20 in the morning here. I've got to go to bed. So,
hey, Phil, thank you so much for calling. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you
for staying up.
Okay.
Hopefully,
cheerio.
Phil, before you go,
yeah.
If you ever, you know, I love that you call, and if you call in again and you think we're off topic, you're the perfect guy to get us back on, because you know it's so easy to get focused on the United States because we live here.
Yeah, that's true. But there's only 9 to 10 minutes left of the thing anyway. So
right,
you carry on talking, but whatever.
And okay.
Okay, well,
maybe,
for calling,
maybe speak to you.
Cheerio,
again.
Phil.
Cheerio. Bye, everyone. Bye.
Well,
there's so much to talk about in politics, I hear you. so much going on.
Well, let's get back to Jason's moral fundamentals.
Well, let's see if I can whip through some of these questions here. And maybe we could take it up in a future podcast. But I said, how should we live? My answer is we should always do as much good as we can. We should always do as little good as we can. And then I ask, what is good? And now here I'm going to give a different answer than I gave
you
before.
You mean little as little evil. You mean as little evil as we can.
That would be nice.
You said good. You said good twice.
I said what is good, and I'm going
good.
To say good is treating living creatures the way they should be treated, and what is evil? Evil is not treating living creatures the way they should be treated. And now before I talk too much, does anybody want to say their piece about any of this?
Who's defining and providing the should?
Well, I'm trying to use my reason to come up with a philosophy that supports, the general happiness. So I guess.
Okay. Well, then what are living creatures?
Ah, that's the next question. Living creatures are individual things that are alive. Humans, animals, plants, and fungi that are alive are living creatures.
And what about bacteria and viruses?
Viruses, are they living creatures or not? They have some of the characteristics of living creatures, but they don't have others. For example, they can't reproduce by themselves.
How about bacteria?
Bacteria would be living creatures.
Okay, just curious.
But wait, let me do this one question, and maybe we'll talk a little bit more. Why is the focus of good and evil on living creatures? Why not God or non-living things such as rocks? And I say, in many cases, we can help living creatures live or die, and we can help living creatures be happy or miserable. Assuming that God exists, we cannot help God live or die because God will always live no matter what we do. God is much more powerful than us. We also should not be able to greatly influence how happy or miserable God is. God is too powerful for us to physically help or hurt. And God should be so wise and mature that God should not be very emotionally affected by anything we do. As for non-living things, things have to be alive before they can be helped, hurt, or killed. And obviously, non-living things are not alive.
I don't know. There's some people who believe that rocks are alive. Yeah, maybe. How do we know rocks aren't alive? Maybe they're just real slow.
Well, I think anything in existence is alive. Like the mere purpose that, what do you constitute as alive? Anything that can, if you put anything under a microscope, you'll find it is moving to some extent. I mean, I think
if we send a spacecraft like Voyager out to the asteroid belt, and we get a little bit of rock from there, we put that under a microscope, we'll find life.
Yeah, you probably find some microbes living. Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it.
Well, it depends on how you define life. So,
well,
I mean, look, Jason, just for the fun of it, we only know what we know based on what we see and how we live, and we know what's alive, at least biological life that we're familiar with.
I think life is defined as something moving, something. Life is defined as something existing. That's what I think. For instance,
there's a lot of people that believe that, Rico, and I'm not disagreeing with it, but for our practical purposes, I'm not sure that I am not going to want a basement and foundation laid for my house because it's going to disturb some rocks.
I don't think that's the approach to take to it. I think, for instance, everything has atoms that is in existence. Atoms can be found in everything. Well, if you look at an atom as an energy unit, for instance, it generates electricity. Things can be stored in it. Intention, as in the Japanese water experiment, their effect of intentions on water or living matter. And if you look at it from that concept or from that point of view, anything that you're coming in contact with is can hold information, whether it's from
that goes back to the the common, the Buddhism. It goes back to some of the basic principles of Buddhism, and I'm not sure that that's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Or at the very least,
it's,
bring it more modern. You know, it's the concept of force.
It also intertwines with, again, the law of cause and effect. You know, if you're knowledgeable about your impact on different things, living, whether you regard them as living or non-living, if you're conscious of that fact, then you can affect your environment and your living situation in a more positive way if you go forward.
Well, especially if you use that along with the law of vibration and the law of polarity.
Yeah, there you go.
Not to leave out the law of rhythm.
Yeah, there you go, and the law of mentality, you know, some of these stationary laws. Now, as far as, I had an interesting concept. It was something you said about God, and it's just my, you know, I'm not an atheist, I'm not a Buddhist, I believe that God is real, but I believe that the definition of God is often misunderstood in a sense.
Hey, Rico, hang on a second. Jason, how much time we got?
We have 4 minutes.
Oh, man.
We're about to get – go ahead. If you can say it quickly, tell us. But
yeah,
we need
I think 2 minutes
to talk.
Oh, okay. I just think that the human being is God. I think that's an interesting concept. You know, we learn from
human
beings.
Well, a lot of people believe something called pan-entheism. Pan means all, en means in, and theism means God. So that means all is in God, all is part of God. Like God is kind of like, it could be like a big brain, and the entire universe, including us, is like a thought of the brain.
Man, you know what? That's what I thought. I always thought the universe was God's mind.
I don't know. I think God's the Higgs boson, the God particle. I don't know. I don't really know.
the God field. Well, hey, I just wanted to say what I think life is, and I try to base all my beliefs on whatever the consensus of trustworthy historians is, whatever the consensus of trustworthy scientists is. They study this more than me, so I try to accept those as truths. And my understanding of what most biologists believe is life is that life is a complex chemical process that has certain attributes such as the ability to reproduce, the ability to move, the ability to process some kind of fuel. I'm not a biologist, but what I would say, whatever the consensus of what biologists believe is life, is what I'm trying to believe. And the reason I focus on treating living creatures well, as opposed to, you know, caring too much about what God thinks or caring too much about, you know, what a rock thinks, which a rock doesn't think, is that I value life, and I'd like, all people to value life and to treat life better. And one of the reasons is, maybe the main reason is to promote the general happiness.
I agree. I think God is. I look at God as like an occupation or an attainment of a degree of knowledge. You know, much is given, much is you're responsible for all that you know. Knowledge is power. So it makes sense to me that God would be just an all intelligent, all knowing human being. That just the dictionary describes him as a supreme being, meaning supreme existence.
I gotta cut you off here, and I'm gonna do the closing to the show. We may not hear all the closing.
Your time
but you
is
all
up.
Take care. Hope you all tune in next Monday, the first Monday of the month. Bye.
Talk to you next Monday. All right.
Hope you enjoyed this presentation. To learn more about deism, please visit www.deism.com. That's deism.com. And visit goddiscussion.com for the latest church and state news, articles, and opinions. The comments and opinions in this broadcast are respected, but do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of other hosts, guests, and or goddiscussion.com.
In a world where a frightening number of Americans think that man coexisted with dinosaurs 6,000 years ago, where church and state are headed for a collision course, you've got one new source that covers it all, GodDiscussion.com. Go there, comment, bookmark it, spread the word, engage. GodDiscussion.com.
Hello?